Jason, we friends just having a conversation.
Wave your hands, hands high.
Don't stop.
Wave your hands, hands high.
Don't stop.
All right, welcome back. This is North Texas Music Fanatics. I am Jason Janik, and we got someone here today who knows his way around a guitar, that's for sure. Why don't we get right into it? This is Ken Bethea.
Hey, what's up, Jason? Thank you for this opportunity to be hanging out with your fanatics today, and we'll talk some music, talk some Texas music, and have a good time, I hope.
Oh, yeah, this will be good. I've known you all for quite a while. I know that I photographed you. I think the first time that I photographed you was the Observer Music Awards that y'all played with. Was it John Doe? Who?
Yeah, we did play. We played several times with John. I don't remember particularly it being at Observer Music Awards, but you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you played so many shows. Yeah. All this stuff kind of runs together at some point.
I do remember playing with John at the Barley House, one old Barley House, and I also remember playing it. Yeah. So yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, well, let me ask you this, because your band, Old 97s, mm-hmm. I think if somebody's into Dallas music, they definitely know of the band.
Right.
It's one of those
Hopefully.
Names. Yes. You've got Tripping Days, you've got Toadies, and I would say probably the third on that list is probably Old 97s for people. So mm-hmm. you clearly have played a lot of places mm-hmm. around town.
Right.
You've clearly played with a lot of other bands around town. But how do you get to that point? Like, what was your beginnings?
The band's beginnings started, I had moved into, it was kind of two pieces. Rhett and Murray had met each other and were kind of doing music together in the 80s. Murray had a band called Peyote Cowboys where he had started in like 84 or 5. And it was this kind of crazy psychedelic band that got to play some gigs with Flaming Lips and got to play some gigs, as we'll talk about a little bit later, I believe, the Butthole Surfers, some stuff like that, right? Then he met Rhett, and if you meet Rhett, he's such a striking personality, first of all, but secondly, as soon as he starts singing and playing guitar right there and you're in the room with him, you're like, this is not normal. You know, and so Murray was blown away. He's like, holy crap. Rhett was opening for Murray's band. So then I had met Philip in Denton. I lived in Denton. We were in a band called the Smeg Winfields together, which was, again, as we're beginning back to this Butthole Surfers talk. That was our icon band. We had a screamer singer. We made noise, and it was fun. But we didn't play that often, and we didn't even have I really didn't hang with Philip before. And so a few years went by, and I moved to Marquis de Court's apartments, which is right like two blocks from Torelli's. And Murray lived across the hall, and Rhett lived on the backside of Marquita.
And this is the time, I think the two of them had, was it Under a Radio Sun was their band? It was like
That's
Dead
the name
Poets.
Of their record.
Oh, that's
It
right.
was called Sleepy Heroes.
Sleepy Heroes, that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
They had a band. They'd gone through a few things. So Rhett had released this solo album that went out and actually reached some people in Dallas where he had sold a couple 3,000 copies of it. And as Murray put it, Rhett's last show before he went away to college was 300 private school girls all sobbing because he was moving away. And that was probably in 89. And then he didn't like college. He came home 6 months later and the girls had all moved away. And now he was no longer popular, which ultimately was really good for me, right? Because by the time I met them in 1992, they had gone through a band called Rhett's Exploding. They had gone through a band called, like we just said, Sleepy Heroes. These were not working. And it was penny stock. And I was able to buy penny stock because I was not a good guitar player. We lived in the same apartments, and we started playing guitars together like one night a week. We were not forming a band, just doing it. This is the fall of 92. This was about the time that the Seinfeld masturbation episode came out. So I always date it by that because we were laughing at that, me and my roommate, and within a week I was playing with those guys, with Rhett Murray. And they had nothing going on, which was really good for me. Because I went to see him before just those two playing one night at Chumley's, and there was four people there, and that included me. And I was like, okay. Because I felt like maybe these guys are kind of rock stars, right? I didn't know. I had never seen them before. I had never seen Peyote Cowboys. I'd never seen Rhett solo. I just knew
that. But Rhett always had that air about him. I mean,
right.
You can even see in his early photos, and it almost looks like he would have been a cast member of like Dead Poets Society.
Right. So I felt like I'm not good enough, right? So, but once we started playing, it felt really good between us three, personality-wise, and also I really was a better guitar player than I thought at the time. And so so we started the band, and by just playing a gig at Chumley's, and it went well, and we just kept booking stuff. And a few months into it, we were going to do folk, just like, let's just be folk, no drummer. Folk meant no drummer, but with electric guitar. We also did instrument switching in those days. I'd play some banjo and play some accordion, and Murray play some banjo, some stuff like that. But anyway, I'd run across Philip, and he wanted to join the band. And we said, sure. We had had another guy playing, just playing to hear what it sounded like. We actually played, you might have been at this, a warehouse show that Tripp and Daisy had in Oak Cliff.
I know of the show. I unfortunately didn't go to that one, but yeah.
Yes. Okay, so we got invited to do it. It's the by then we had just named the band Old 97s, but I remember on the t-shirt of that show, it said Rhett Miller Band or something like that. But in order to play it, someone that was running it, putting the thing together, probably maybe Chris or somebody like Chris Penn or someone like that, probably wasn't Tim, it doesn't sound like Tim, had said, but you need a drummer. Don't show up without a drummer. there were other, like Vibralux was on the bill. I think Purvis was on the bill. It was 1993, Deep Ella Music, you know, was all on the bill. And so we got this guy, Darren, who I had been in band with before, and Philip had too, who's really a singer, Darren Lynn Wood. But Darren played drums. He had a band called Fireworks, if you ever saw Fireworks in those days. And he was the singer of Fireworks. So Darren played drums with us for about 8 shows, just really, for us, he wasn't a real drummer, and he was really working on his other band. It was sort of fill-in type of thing, but more than anything, it made the songs, we're like, we need a real drummer, this sounds good. And so I had known Philip from the other band, and he joined in, and it's been the same for us ever since, which is kind of crazy. But
yeah, it's kind of cool that you have stuck the way that you have, because so few bands, I mean, even with like Bowling for Soup, who's been around since, you know, the late-ish 90s, I mean, they had a drummer before Gary, and then after Eric left, they brought in a new bassist. Yeah. Bands just don't do that. They don't stick with the same 4 members for 30-something
years. It's super abnormal, especially once I heard a great speech about it by Brian Hinneman. He's a singer of the Bottle Rockets. But fundamentally, what Brian's talking about is, let's consider ZZ Top. ZZ Top basically had the same band members. Well, guess what? It's easy to stay in ZZ Top. You get paid, I don't know, $1 million or more every time they play. Each band member gets over $1 million. Well, guess what? Even if you're not super happy with each other, it's a good payday, right? But when you're in the Bottle Rockets or the Old 97s, you actually have to ride in the same van sometimes with these people that you maybe be tired of their jokes after 30 years. So, but we're still pretty good friends. I mean, not even pretty good, really good friends. It's pretty nice because when we get together, it's all like, even though Philip really lives close to me, we don't usually hang that much here, but then we get on tour, we hang out all the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, like any job, I'm sure, you know, there's people when it's time to work, and that's your family.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So you had kind of jokingly said that you didn't feel like you were the best guitar player at the time. How did you get into guitar? I know from Facebook that you were big into sports in high school.
Right.
You got those classic kind of, early 80s baseball, and I think did you play football as well?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you go from being a sports guy into being a guitar maestro?
It started, my dad was our head football coach. So I was raised, that was all, it was everything. You know, sports was everything. I'm from an area just outside of Tyler called Chapel Hill. And so that was my upbringing, you know, Chapel Hill Bulldogs, and I was going to go play not only for the Cowboys, but also the Texas Rangers. I was going I was going to do Deion. And then, you know, some point, and I was good at sports. So I started and got all district and stuff like that in both sports in high school. But, you know, you hit that thing right around eighth or ninth grade going, it's not that many 5'10", 155 starting football players for the Cowboys, right? And you start realizing that's probably not going to work out. At about that time, I really, at our house, the only real music was, my mom was into Barbra Streisand, and my dad had a Merle Haggard 8-track, and my sister had a Osmonds and Partridge Families. Sorry, so I grew up in the 70s, right? This is all 70s stuff. And I didn't have any of my own music. I just wasn't even interested to get it. And so But I still know all that stuff by heart. I still get really excited if I hear Osmond's song, and so, or Barbara's song, right?
Well, so, and I mean, Barbara, if you can appreciate her, and this was before auto-tune, I mean, everything is just right on. Yeah.
So if you listen to her first record, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I've listened to it before on tour and just like going, because that was not the record we had. We had a couple others. I don't know what they were called. We weren't records, they were 8-tracks. But you listen to Barbara Streisand's first record and you're like, wow, you know, this is insane. So anyway, but when I got in 9th grade, I met this guy at my school. We worked together that summer, named Terry Holt. And Terry was really, he was the guy. If you ever see the movie, Commitments, right in the beginning, they talk about the guy at the guy in the hood that always knows everything about the music before everybody else does. Terry was that guy at our school. And he got me into Kansas. He had this Kansas. I knew the song Dust in the Wind, but he gave me the 8-track. And I would drive around listening to this thing, or listening to it in my room. At that time, I didn't have a car yet. And just like going, wow, all these songs are good. It's not just Dust in the Wind and Point of No Return. Sparks of the Tempest is good. You know, it's all this prog. I didn't even know what that meant. I just was. So I started buying my own music. And the first thing I went and bought, I've never forgotten this, of my own money, I went and bought 4 8-tracks. And it was Queen. I did know Bohemian Rhapsody. So I was a Queen fan, but only knew that song at the time. But I bought the brand new Queen. I bought Queen Jazz. I bought a Parliament record because I knew it was popular in the field house. Barry Manilow, even now, had Copacabana on it. And Wings, London Town.
Well, there's quite a variety, and it's all, I mean, in their own genre, those are killer bands and killer albums.
But I think it's, and I don't, there wasn't an agenda of all other than, oh, this looks good. I bet this is good. This is supposed to be good. You know, it's so raw. I was in 9th grade going in 10th grade. It was just a music selection. And then I just OD'd on music. And by the time I was out of high school, I was the guy everybody was coming to for the music. Me and this other friend of mine, we were listening to all the cool stuff, right? All the Cheap Trick, all the Ramones, all the business like that. Which, I graduated high school in 81.
Couldn't have been that easy to find outside of Tyler at that time, but
you couldn't find anybody really. You had to kind of dig around or come to Dallas or something like that to get, you know, most. But really in those days, I mean, like for instance, the Clash was on Epic. You could get any Clash record anywhere. Sex Pistols were on what, EMI or whatever. You know, you could get this, you could get that things. What you couldn't get was like a Cramps record. That wasn't going to happen. You know?
Well, and you could walk into Sears and they had their music department.
Right.
And it wasn't, it had some amount of variety.
Hey, two of my cornerstone albums, Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell and Ziggy Stardust, I bought at Dillard's.
Yeah.
On sale. Exactly. And, you know.
No, I remember getting Rick Springfield's Living in Oz at Sears in Town East when I was a kid.
Yeah. Are you from?
So I grew up out in Rockwall.
Okay.
And then, you know, I mean, Town East was the closest place at the time.
But see, Rockwall's, even now, but certainly then, a little bit of a small.
Oh, yeah, it was. Isolated town. Yeah, it was definitely small back then. Well, let's do this. So I think this would be a good time to take a quick break and hear something that you played on. So let's play some old 97s.
Great.
Jagged, I'd give anything not to feel so this make sense? But I think I better give it a try. There's no settling down, there's only driving down the state. So I drive.
So that was fun. You know, during that song, I was thinking it's crazy that you picked up Parliament, or you said Funkadelic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That just does not seem like a Tyler band to me. You said it was played in the Fieldhouse. I mean, it's obviously something that's fun to work out to or whatever. But
sure.
I mean, most of the stuff out there must have been country, right?
Yeah, it was. Well, it was really three kinds of kids in my high school. Four, if you want to count me and my two or three friends, that mainly country. So this would have been the heyday of like Alabama and Urban Cowboy, or like soul music. So 40% of my high school was black kids. So Earth, Wind & Fire, Parliament, Teddy Pendergrass, this was big players around there that would always get played around. And then there was also kind of the rocker crowd, you know, like Molly Hatchet or Boston, you know, Peter Frampton.
Fog Hat, stuff like
yeah,
that.
Fog yeah, Fog Hat, that's right. So then, so yeah, so... And I was really like you probably would think, more into Cheap Trick, the Cars, the Talking Heads, but also was really into Rush. But even Rush is kind of oddball. Like most of the rockers didn't like Rush because it's
yeah,
it probably came
prog.
From the Kansas, yeah, too prog. Probably came from the Kansas connection or whatever. Whatever. I'm still a big Rush fan. So
let me ask you this: growing up out there at that time, would you say it felt a little bit like the movie Dazed and Confused?
It was exactly. To a T. My life, there you got the baseball playing kid. So the kid, so Mitch in Dazed and Confused, the pitcher, he would be 1 year older than me. So he's going into ninth grade. I would have been going to eighth grade when the movie is on. Everything about that movie is so much my life. You're living out there, setting things on fire. Hey man, you got a joint. Older dudes hitting on the young girls. I could just go through our high school. And my sister was a head cheerleader. So when I moved into high school, when the hazing started, I really didn't get hazed because they all wanted to bang my sister. So it was, I laugh so much at that movie. It's so much like my high school.
So Ben Affleck didn't want to paddle you.
No,
all
no,
right,
no.
There you go.
No, just let me by.
Yeah. So, I mean, cause when you started listing off some of those bands, I was like, that's clearly that soundtrack.
Totally.
But you had also mentioned you grew up with Merle Haggard.
Yes.
I mean, what other country was there?
There were kids, you know, I didn't really like any of the country, the Merle Haggard, and even that seemed like my dad's stuff. Like I wasn't into any of that Alabama, anything like that. I was against it. I said it was crappy. Can we swear on this?
It's okay. Don't go crazy, but
yeah, it was just shitty. I thought it was shitty music, you know, all country was terrible. So of those three, I liked the kind of some of the hard, you know, classic rock songs and classic rock bands. I liked some of the soul bands and stuff like that. To this day, I don't have any lyric or country. I don't really listen to Willie Nelson. I know you're supposed to. Just not my thing. I do know a couple of Willie's records, but so.
I don't think it's the end of the world if somebody doesn't like an artist, even if they're as big as Willie, honestly. Yeah. I think that music is going to touch you in a certain way.
Right.
And it either touches you or it doesn't.
Right. That's, you know what? I'm in a band with guys that don't really love Bob Marley. And I just can't, we don't fuss over it. I don't really care. I love the Doors and Bob Marley, and the other guys in my band really don't. But they like Big Star, and I'm just like, eh. I'd rather listen to Bob Marley than Big Star. So anyway. But what happened with the country thing for me was when I went away to college. And so I started school in San Marcos, and then I there a couple years, then I went to UT. So I spent those formative years out of high school basically in Austin, you know, and obviously that's where you see bands that you see great bands playing in places that hold 100 people, right? Which had never been part of my life because in Tyler, we didn't get any bands coming there. And then we would come to Dallas, but it would be huge shows at Reunion Arena. So even in those days, I wouldn't have known about like the Hot Club here, which everybody talks about. That was too underground for me. I was coming from East Texas. It was super underground where I came from to go to Reunion Arena. That's how rinky-dink it was, you know. And we would come up and see whatever, AC/DC or something, and we go, oh, man, it's the best, you know.
Well, I'm sure, Tyler, they probably had like your dance hall. Like we had out in Rockwall, we had Southern Junction, and I saw Tracy Lawrence there, you know. But you wouldn't see somebody like George Clinton come through there.
No. I saw Three Dog Night there once. That was about it. I saw Mel Tillis there once at a rodeo. Really, there was a couple discos, one called the Light Lab, one called Phase 21. And there's people would play there, but I mean, it wasn't real music. Yeah. Vince Vance and the Valiants would play there.
Oh, yeah.
So, but once I moved to Austin, you know, I got super fortunate, and I lived across the hall in the dorm, this guy named Brett Anderson, who was a big-time skater. Still lives in San Marcos, still skates. He's that guy. And we start bonding on this music, and he gave me a cassette. And on one side of the cassette was a bunch of Black Flag, and the other side of the cassette was Joe Ely's record called Must Have Not Have Got a Lotta.
That's quite a combo.
I mean, I was just like, wow, this is... And I just went back and forth with that cassette. You know, I'd listen to one end to the other, one end to the other. And really both of it super influenced my taste because the first time you hear hardcore, I don't care who you are. It just sounds crappy and sorry, right? I've heard people before go, oh man. I'm like, not the first time you heard it. Everybody's first time they hear it, it's awkward. I mean, I guess maybe whatever now, but I'm talking certainly in 1981 when Journey is dominating the charts and somebody plays you Black Flag music. And then I got to where I just got it. I understood what was going on, and you fall in love with it. Like, oh, man, I need more of this kind of music. The same thing happened with the countryside, with the Joe Ely side. If you know Joe's music, it's not country, but certainly not hit country. But it's country music, you know, a little bit of rockabilly in there. And I became obsessed with that, too, and looking for more of that kind of music and understood that there can be – that was really understood that music – You can't just write off an entire genre. I don't listen to a ton of hip hop, but I certainly can go and drag out a bunch of hip hop and go, man, this is really good. You know, you just listen to it. It's just not my total jam all the time, but there's good music in everything. It's just it's silly if you don't see that, right?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I've been lucky enough with Dallas Morning News sending me to everything,
right?
And I discovered that there were certain Norteño bands that I loved. You know, I don't speak Spanish, so I don't know what they're singing about, but it's just absolutely gorgeous music,
right?
So yeah, I get it.
That's
a great
example.
Tell me this. So you mentioned that. How long after listening to that tape did you start trying to look for and consume other things in the same genre?
Immediately, like, you know, right then. But let's talk about this part of it, because I think it's at least, well, it's the reason I'm on this podcast. How did it change the way I play guitar? Because up until that point, realistically, I was a big AC/DC fan. I love Angus Young, and I'm a big Stones fan. And so those are two artists that I would try to learn. I was just learning guitar in those days, in 81 and 2. I was just learning it. So I would try to do their stuff much as I could. Stray Cats had just blown up, and I kind of got into that. I was like, okay, this is like rockabilly music, which I'd never heard, 50s sounding music, but it's guitar bass rather than vocals and saxophone or whatever, which you normally think of as 50s music. And then I'd really gotten into Clash, and I was starting to learn learn that all that was happening at the same time. The Joe Ely thing was interesting to me because it validated country. It put Joe right in there with Joe's tour with the Clash, right? This put him on level with a band like that, which before I would have thought Joe Ely is crap because he's not whatever. He's not some, you know what I mean?
Because you can't find his record in Dillard's.
Yeah, and yeah, that's right. And he's just some country guy. And all of a sudden it validated it. And from there, I added to my repertoire. So I started trying to learn to play all that kind of music, and some of it is harder to do than others. But, you know, and something we're going to talk about in a little bit. I also had found out by then that I'm not a real fast guitar player. Like, I can't make my left hand go as fast as I had friends that even then and even now, they just go real fast. So that was a bit of a downer because I was like, yeah, this is not good. I wish that my fingers would go faster, but I'm having troubles with this. Yeah, so then but back to that Joe Ely thing, I started looking into the Jerry Jeff Walkers of the world, went to see him a couple times. Within a year or two, I'd moved to Austin to go to UT, and there was a couple bands there that I got into that really changed my guitar world, and that was Butthole Surfers and a band called the Hickoids. And that was huge because the Hickoids are, you know, when people call my band or call bands cowpunk, I only really know one real cowpunk band, and that's the Hickoids. They're an actual cowpunk band. Like, that's just what they sound like. If you listen to it, you're like, yeah, this is cowpunk. Jason Scorchers was not a cowpunk band. They were just, I mean, they have elements.
That's bar rock.
Yeah. What it was. Well, they have elements like my band does. Like, but at some point, punk gets watered down. But what we all think of as old school punk rock, things aren't in tune. There's screaming going on, and it's recorded poorly. And that's what you love about it. That's the part that you can't get with my band because the singers are going to sing in tune.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get that. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell the listeners, this show is very open format. There's no questions beforehand because it's just supposed to be two friends talking. Mm-hmm. But there is one thing that we do set up beforehand. I ask each guest, are there a few bands that you think would be interesting to talk about? And up until now, I've known every single band, and I've had it on my wall of CDs or records. And you are the first one to stump me because I had only heard of the Hickoids. I don't have any of their music. I don't know what they sound like. I had only heard of them because, you know, they're known as right. being, you know, 80s Austin. So I'm excited to get to that. I think we should listen to that here in a little bit. But it would make more sense for us to kick into one of Joe's songs.
Right.
And I know you had told me earlier that you really like Dallas.
Yes.
So what if we play that?
Sure.
How about a 1, 2? Did you ever see Dallas from a DC-9? Well, Dallas is a jewel. Dallas is a beautiful sight. And Dallas is a jungle, but Dallas gives a beautiful life. See 9 at 9. Well, Dallas is a from a BC 99. Well, Dallas is a jewel. Dallas is a beautiful sight. And Dallas is a jungle, but Dallas gives a beautiful light.
All right, well, Dallas was a real solid song. Like you were mentioning earlier, the Hickoids. I mean, let's talk about that more, because I don't really know anything about them. Fill me in.
So the Hickoids is a band. They still have a band. There's only one, not only one original band member in it, he's the only one still alive. His name's Jeff Smith. Jeff is a friend of mine now. I didn't know him those days because he was a rock star. I was a minion. You know, I was showing up the show.
Everyone starts somewhere, right?
You got to start somewhere. I was starting at the Beach Cabaret in Austin, Texas in the fall of 84. They were a terrific band that was a lot of screaming. Lyrically, if you go through Jeff's lyrics, they're actually pretty good too. That's another thing that, like, if you don't dig a little deeper, because he's kind of just screaming, especially early Hickoids. But they also had a killer guitar player whose name was Jukebox. And Jukebox would do this thing on his guitar where he had a tremolo on it, like the bar, right? And he'd go, and it would sound like a horse. I don't know if he was trying to make it sound like a horse. I've never even asked Jeff this. I should. But to me, it sounded like a horse, and it was perfect. It'd be, and it's loud. It's loud, obnoxious, but it was just beautiful. And just like, I was like, wow.
Well, I guess that kind of fits in, because you get a lot of that whammy bar in like surf rock, and surf rock is connected to the early rockabilly, and rockabilly is connected to cowpunk, and so I'm sure he had certain influences that brought him to that point.
No question.
So how did they? I mean, because I've listened to you progress through your albums and see where your guitar playing went. Before you started recording with the old 97s, I mean, how did you see that progression? How did these people influence you? Because you mentioned, you know, you were playing some AC/DC, stuff like that. You got into Hickoids. Where does that go?
The biggest difference between those two bands, and I know we could, besides their bank account, is that, you know, a band like AC/DC, if you're going to be in a band like that and be a guitar player, you're going to have to be able to rip out an extended 2 to 3 minute solo, right? This is just part of the deal. And I just kind of didn't see myself ever as being that guy. And again, I mentioned I was more of a Stones guy, and you don't hear that in the Stones, right? And I was like Keith Richards, and I still think about it. If Keith can do it, I can do it, right? You know, so you get into a band like the Hickoids, who were, Jukebox is a pretty good guitar player, but still in the end, that's not what, you know, this is not everyone leaves the stage and he takes a solo music, right? And plus, you could see a band like that in a little bitty place, like would have like 40 people there, 50 people there. And yet I had their record. And I love that. I got their record and all these songs, and you can just go stand there and listen, and it's going to be right there.
Were they
there.
Usually like a three-piece type of thing?
It was five of them.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a second guitar player, Davey, and Davey just passed away fairly recently. I believe Davey and Jeff were super tight. But to me, the guitar player that was so different was Hickoid. Davey was kind of a typical guitar player, you know, playing parts here and there, whatnot. Les Paul guy, I think. But so I could see myself being in a band like that, and I could if I squinted a little bit, I'd be like, wow, I could start a band like this. And there was a time period where I started writing songs, and I was a singer because there wasn't anyone else in my friend group.
I was going to ask you about that at some point. I don't want to get too far off topic, but I know Rhett's got his solo albums because I did one of the album covers for it. Murray's got a solo.
Right.
I mean, have you ever thought about putting out a solo album?
I have. You know, I had this band called The Scrap Hotel in like 2001 that we had played about 20 songs. I was a singer. It was kind of like the like the brass ring, you know, and that what
that
is, where you have an achievement. And after about 20 shows, I was like, I can honestly say I'm good. And I occasionally want to start a band around here. I don't really like being the singer. You know, I don't mind singing a few songs, but I don't like being the singer. It's not as fun. Playing guitar is fun. Doing what I do in the All Night Sevens is a blast every night. So I have seen one song in the All Night Sevens called Coahuila. And I get asked a lot, maybe I'll never play that. I'm like, to be fair, I don't ever ask. I'm good without it. But, you know, and every now and then it gets thrown on me, and Rel just put it in the set list. I'm like, okay, I have to get, then I've got to, I get nervous, you know, I got to worry about, because like, we don't play very much.
But. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense. Oh. Even with me having, you know, 30 years of professional photography experience, usually that dead time between Christmas and then things start to pick up at the beginning of February, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I'm rusty. I'm kind of nervous with this first shoot back into it.
That's right.
It's, you know, it's like riding a bike, but at the same time, at the level you're at, or the level with, you know, if I've got to do something for a magazine cover,
right.
It's like riding a bike on like a BMX Tony Hawk type level.
It is. Well, you're getting paid to do it.
Yeah.
Everything in life, realistically, becomes hobby or profession, right? I mean, I played sports. I've played sports as an adult, but those are hobbies. Those are things that in the end, when you're playing for reals, there's a huge difference between a touring band and a local band. I mean, there just is. The local bands, there's most time, you know,
It's all your friends show up to that versus you're going into a town and these strangers paid to see you entertain them.
Yeah. And you're doing it 6 out of 7 nights. And it's different every day. And the reality is, you're just doing what you do, as Rhett says on one of our songs, you know, because it's just what you do. And the cool part is you get into this zone. I get into the zone on tour to where the best part of the day is the show, and the really best part of the show is showing out on the guitar in the way I show out. And it's not being big talk or egotistical or anything. It's just it's like if you really, really like playing basketball, it's the game.
Yeah, no
doubt. The game is more important than practice.
But I can't get enough of when you kick into Jagged. And it's interesting because you don't put that tone on, I mean, really any other song. That mm-hmm. song,
right?
When you play it, is so unique and special. Mm-hmm. And I don't even have a question about it. I wanted to cheer about how beautiful the guitar is on Jagged. Mm-hmm. How do you come about, how do you develop the sound on each album or each song?
So really, for me, I think the thing that I'm good at better, even more than sound, because a lot of people, chasing sound is something you work out with the producer and you do this and that. And that's the only tone I have on anything on that tone of Jagged, because I use this weird pedal that I have in my attic. Yeah, I have a video about it. I don't know if you ever saw that. But I'll send it to you.
Okay, yeah.
I have an actual video about the sound of that song. That's the only song we have like that. The way I do guitar, again, I know I'm not a speed freak, and I'm on in a band that wants some Satriani-type guy, right? So one of my proudest songs, and this goes back to the first song we did as me, Rhett, and Murray. So Rhett came in with these other songs. Some of them are on our first record, like St. Ignatius, he'd already written. Victoria, already written. Desperate Times, already written. Drown of the Day is already written. So there were certain songs that are already there. But the first song he wrote after me, him, and Murray started playing was our song called Stoned. So we had gone down to Austin, played this little barbecue joint down there that we used to play every other week in front of 6 people. But it was fun. It was a great bonding experience. It gave us something to do every other Friday night. We'd drive down there for about 2 months. And one of those Friday nights, we went to Fredericksburg and crawled on Enchanted Rock and did the thing you do, you know, and hanging out in the hill country and bonding. And we came back and I was like, this is really starting to feel like a little band. And Rhett comes up and he says, I wrote a new song. It's called Stoned. And he played it. And I was like, okay, I got to come up with something, right? And it's slower. It's not a fast song or anything. And so I thought, you know what? I'm going to play this part as if I'm the stoner guy in the apartment and the other guy has written a little song and I'm going to play stone guitar part, you know? So I, on purpose, played the riff of Stoned. I did it to sound like a stonery thing. And then when it gets to the solo, all I do is play Chuck Berry riff. Because again, that's a stoner guitar thing to do. Like I'm at the blues jam, and it's my turn. I'm just gonna play some blues riffs, right? And I was like, this is the way stoner guys play guitar. And I liked that the style, the form was echoing the content, right? It's a song about being stoned. I'm gonna play guitar like it's being stoned. And I immediately latched onto that idea with the band. Not that I certainly haven't invented this idea, but it was new to me because first of all, I liked it. I just thought it was a cool thing to be doing. And secondly, it works when you're not a really shredder guitar player. So it's, and I do the same thing to all these days. I mean, we have songs.
It works really well because I can listen to any single song. And you're right, the guitar really wraps itself around the lyrics.
Yeah.
So that, I think that explains a lot.
Okay, opposite of scale was when we did Murder or Heart Attack. This is a very L.A. record. Rhett wrote the song in L.A. when he lived there with his roommate about his roommate's cat, Charlie. We were on a major label. We were not the band we were in Deep Ellum at the beginning. We were different world. So we get ready for the solo, and I said, I'm going to put a shredder of a solo I can put because we're only like, four blocks from Sunset Boulevard. I'm going to do my version of, and so when you listen to the solo on Murder, it's very, for me, Motley Crue. I know it's not like Motley Crue, but it's for me in my head. And secondly, when I go to the second pass, so the second four, the first three notes I go as a, I do a da-na-na-na, Nicky, Nicky, noo, noo, stick your head in doo-doo, or poo-poo, or whatever. I play that part. And that is something me and my wife used to say about our cat. So I'm telling more story. Telling more story with the guitar.
There's actual depth behind it. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And I mean, it shows in the music. Yeah. That's 100%. Let's do this. I think it's about time to hear something else.
Sure.
Who all did we talk about this segment?
Well, the next one here that probably is kind of what we're talking about was back in the 80s, I'd become a big Butthole Surfers fan. And one thing I learned about them is that, again, you don't have to be a shredder guitar player to, their guitar player, Paul Leary, is awesome, but he's just kind of a noise guy. And that was super cool. I forgot which record. I didn't put Lady Sniff down. What I put down? What's the name of
that? You had told me that you wanted to listen to Mexican Caravan.
Yeah, Mexican Caravan.
Oh, or wait, we talked about Hickoids a little earlier. We should play them right now.
Okay.
And let's talk about some Butthole Surfers when we get back.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
We ain't no slick band from Nashville. slick band from Nashville.
Okay, so just before hearing that, you had mentioned Butthole Surfers, and I know that's one of the bands that was on your list. So why don't you tell me, I mean, what is it about them?
You know, like anybody, there's that point, this is early 80s stuff, and that point where even whatever you were currently listening to didn't seem like it was enough. And so this friend of mine, the same Brett guy who gave me the Black Flag thing, had brought up the Butthole Surfers to me. And I, you know, like anybody, you laugh at the band name. And then he showed me that first album cover with the swollen bellies on it. And I'm just like, this is crazy. I need to record this. And I just immediately loved it. It's crazy. It's crazy music, right? If you know who the Surfers are, it's crazy music. So I really got into it as a listener. But as time went by, I really liked the way this guitar player would play. His name's Paul Leary. And the song that we'll play in a little bit, he's called Mexican Caravan. He's kind of he's pushing his strings out of tune a little bit, and it adds tension and chaos. Right? It's not that he's not in tune. He's bending the strings out of tune, and I was like, that's super cool. You know, I really like this, and he does it a lot in that band. Later, there was a time where we were talking to Produce Salah. Right? He produced a Toadies record, and he produced that Sublime record that everybody loves. And of all things, Gibby, their lead singer, grew up and went to elementary right here, White Rock Elementary.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, because his dad was on TV.
He's on TV. Yeah. He grew up on Bucks Hill.
Yeah.
I know the house. So anyway, I just became a big Surfers fan, right? And they were the one Austin band that was national. Those other bands were not, you know, the other bands that were in that Austin scene that day, True Believers, Scratch Acid, Doctor's Mob, Glass Eye, Daniel Johnson, all of them, they were not national bands, Zeitgeist. They were.
Well, it always amazes me because I dig for a lot of records. My collection is pretty big. And so I'm always looking for new stuff. And the amount of Austin bands from the 80s that I'll find a record and you can find just the tiniest bit of info. It amazes me how much stuff there was in Austin at that time.
If you ever really want to know, just let me know or follow a guy that's on my thing. The singer of the Hickories, Jeff Smith, is a great dude. He's the godfather. He knows it all. He has got a record label that he still runs. Like, he released a record called Bands on the Block, which had one of those. All those bands I just mentioned and
so
much more.
He's the 80s Austin. He's like the Jeff Lyles of Austin.
Yes, yeah. Except for he's a singer. He's in the band instead, whereas Jeff is the kind of the shadowy figure behind the puppet master behind the scenes.
If there's ever a band you don't know, I can usually go to Jeff and he's absolutely. Like, oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Then I have a good anecdote about spending the time with him, this band, Iggy Pop, and John Paul Jones when I'm in L.A. or some crazy story. He's got great stories.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, that was the deal with the Surfers. So the other reason I brought them up on this Deep Ellum podcast was I had struck out with my life. I was out of a job. I didn't like East Texas. I was out of college and I didn't know what to do. And I had, you know, $175, right? So my grandfather lived in Mesquite. So I came up and spent the week with him at his house and looked for a job up here. And didn't find a job, but I did drive around. It was a good week. It was a good week. But the other thing I wanted to do, I'd heard of Deep Ellum. I didn't know where it was, but I at least had heard of it. It had made its way down to Austin. And like many people from Austin, not that I'm from there, but I had lived there at that point 4 or 5 years, you think everything in Austin is amazing, everything in Dallas is stupid. Right. They still go by this, right? It's the Achilles heel of Austin. They pretend that Dallas is so arrogant, they become arrogant about it. They're arrogant about their view on Dallas. And so I got the Dallas Observer and already was like, all right, they have one of these. You know, they don't want, you know, I knew what this was. But we don't have that in Tyler, like the Alternative Weekly, but they had it in Austin and they had it here. And I'm looking around and I found some a club called Club Clearview. And on Wednesday night, the Butthole Surfers were playing. And I was like, bro, I am in. This is awesome. And they were on a street called Elm Street. And I said, Elm, it's got to be the same thing. So I got my DOS server. I left Mesquite. I got on 30. It was coming down. I'll never forget. I think about it every time I've over. It's so funny that I've lived my life here because at the time it all felt foreign. I took Ferguson exit because there was a beer store down there. And I went down there and got a beer, a six pack of Old Milwaukee. Got back on 30 and drove to Deep Ellum for the first time. And so I'm drinking my Old Mill, and I pulled up down there and I got in the line, and everybody was in a line was super nice to me. I told them I didn't know anybody, that I'm an outsider from Tyler, and they're all laughing about that. You know, what are you doing here? Well, I'm telling my story, and everybody could not have been cooler. I go inside. There was a band called The Daylights, which apparently was a big band at the time, from Dallas opening. They were very, at least my memory of them, were very Stooges, you know, kind of like yelling punk funk kind of stuff. They were good. And then Boho Surfers played. I joined the Dance Around Mosh Pit. I got a giant black eye that night, and I went home and I said, Dallas is a good town. I need to. It changed my thoughts because everything to Dallas to me up to that point would have been coming to my grandmother's, going to North Park, and then going to Reunion Arena. And all those things reinforced this Austin view that you're only going to have fun in Dallas if you're spending money. And then I go out to Deep Ellum, and I'm like, they don't have anything like this in Austin. Because you go to 6th Street, it's kind of prissy, right? Compared to here. This is 80s Deep Ellum. There was just as much going on down there. A couple street lights and Clearview. It is at the Clearview. It was at the Clearview position where it always was when you were all 90s. Yeah. But apparently it was somewhere else. That wasn't the original place of Clearview, but I don't know about that.
Yeah, when I first started going to Clearview, I mean, this was mid-90s by then. That was when it was connected to Blind Lemon, right. And was it Art Bar or something? Yeah.
And the little dance hall in there. Little, where there'd be a girl dancing in there wearing a striped.
I always stuck right to Clearview, though, right. Because that's where, you know, I'd see Super Drag, I'd see Chomsky, I'd see John Dufalo play. Mm-hmm. Everybody took that little stage. It was such a small stage there, but it was so much fun.
So the stage before, when I first went there, if you walked in, it was up and to the right.
Okay.
And it was probably the space that was the Blind Lemon. It was different. It was like a big square. So that stage to the left when you walked in wasn't there. It was to the right. That's what it was at the Boho Surfers. That seemed to change that around 92.
Yeah, yeah. One or two. That makes sense. I first started going down there in, I think, 93.
Right.
So I was experiencing, you know, right as Trees was becoming big, right as you had, you know, Clearview being what it was through the 90s era, you saw, you know, Curtain Club come about, Liquid Lounge, all that kind of stuff.
Right,
there was
right.
still Lasers was down there, but I don't think they had live music there. Yeah, it was in July Alley, all that stuff.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that was... So the window for me in Deep Ellum, it's two different windows. There was the first 5 years I went as a fan and all these bands, right? There was a band called About Nine Times that I thought was good because they had a flute player in the band and she also sang. And her brother was the drummer. And he was like the angry drummer. And she was the sweet sweetheart. I don't know if she was a sweetheart. But do you know Jim Cock?
The name rings a bell. I don't know him.
He's a keyboard player. Jim's in the Elton Johns, which is the Elton
Johns.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, sure.
He's the keyboard player there with our drummer, Philip. So I've gotten to know Jim. But I love that band. The New Bohemians were blowing up.
That's right.
Like, I was like, okay, Dallas is big enough that they've got a cool band that is now a national thing. You know, big nationally, number one hit, right?
Yeah, because by 89, I mean, they were playing all over the world.
Yeah. So, because I moved here. I came to that thing in 87, and I moved here in 88, the summer of 88. So I was starting to see bands here that I really liked.
So who all, because I know the stories, I know the late 80s stuff, you know, because Jeff's talked about it a bunch.
Right.
You had like Horton Heat, you had
Three on
Lips.
A Hill.
Three on a Hill. Yeah. I mean,
the
Trees. Who all were you seeing?
Okay, it's kind of funny. I didn't ever see several of those. But the ones that I saw that I liked, I saw Killbilly and liked them. And that was a big player on the 187 sound, and also their drummer, Mike Schwedler. Have you ever met Mike?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Have you ever done this with Mike?
No, I haven't had it on the show yet.
You should podcast with Mike. He's amazing. He knows it all. Podcast with Mike. You talk to him about Mother Blues, where he lived in the 70s, and how many gigs a year he would play. He's old school. He is so interesting and old school. It's love talking to Mike about this, but he was our manager. He was our first manager. So he was our manager for 4 or 5 years. So.
Oh yeah, that's right. I think he shared a few photos when we did that, that art show at Kettle.
Yes. Yeah. So, but like I said, I was kind of going to Dada. So if you were a Dada band in those days, like Cafe Noir, Little Jack Melody, Young Turks, who really was my favorite of that group, of that world, Lisa Loeb. I saw Lisa at open mic. They had that
Tom
Pregene open mic. I saw Lisa there one time. And so it was a little bit not really the rockin' bands that I was seeing. And then I moved to Denton for 1 year. That's where I met Philip and really... and my wife, actually, Heather, and I met up there. And so up there, I got to know some other bands and stuff like that. So you know how you do. You're listening to all this music. At some point after I moved back to Dallas, I went to see Trippin' Daisy and was pretty blown away. I'd heard that they were the big thing, so of course I thought they were going to suck. Because, right, this is the way our brains work. If everyone else likes them, they're probably stupid. And I went and I was like, this is a great band. This is what you call seeing a band...
Oh yeah,
before they're huge,
and that I mean at that time too, you had where they had the multiple projectors going, yep. And you had the bubbles and the smoke and just everything that other bands weren't doing in Deep Ellum. Because I remember seeing them for the very first time in '93.
Yeah,
I just had no clue that kind of thing could even exist. They made my brain explode.
The show I saw, I brought this up to Tim before, and he just laughed and he goes, "Yeah, it sounds about right." Part of it was they had a big buildup before they walked out, which is not normal really for smaller bands. They weren't tiny certainly, but there was probably not 300 people there because I don't think there. I can't remember what venue it was. It was full, but the only 300 person venue in Deep Ellum then would have been Trees. It wasn't in Trees. Whatever it was, probably 200 people, but it felt like a big show.
Maybe Dada.
It wasn't Dada. It was on Main Street. There was a place called. I don't know if it was a Galaxy. It wasn't like that Galaxy.
I know they played Galaxy because I saw them during the Lure tour at the Galaxy Club. They played as the Hula Poppers. But yeah, I mean, one of those small places. And I know Tim had said that they kind of put in big productions even on like their first open mic type of thing. Yeah. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it was. This was probably 90. It was 92 or 3. But regardless, it was only with Bill, but it was getting local edge airplay. But Tim walks out wearing a white t-shirt that had a Pepsi logo on it, but instead of Pepsi, it said sperm. And I was like, okay, this is fun. And then I think it must have been Wes or Mark, had a shirt that said Gilbert. It was a local rock critic, like another version of Wolanski, slightly pre-Wolanski. And it said, it wasn't Manny Mendoza, I don't think, but let's just say Manny Mendoza because I'm friends with Manny. It said Manny Mendoza sucks on his shirt. So I'm like, all right, bitching about the local guy, rock critic, got sperm on this shirt, big production, I'm in. And then, of course, the band starts, and more than anything, it's Tim's vocal mix
for
guitar, and you're like, this is a cool band.
Well, let's do this. Let's go ahead and play another song. Mm-hmm. We talked about Trippin' Daisy. We talked about, we talked about Butthole Surfers. Let's go ahead and play that song.
Okay. We'll be right back.
right. So that was great hearing some of the stuff that you were listening to live in the late 80s. By the time we reach a few years later, old 97s are starting. You're playing some small places. Who all are you playing with?
Well, most of the places you wouldn't necessarily be two bands in one night. So this would have been, we started the band at Chumley's, and we actually did a couple of times, played one time with a band called Hank and Patsy, which was, if you know the Marshall Crenshaw song called Someday, Sunday, like that was an 80s hit, early 80s hit. Mitchell, his brother. So it was Mitchell was the Hank, and his wife was, I don't know her first name, Amy. Amy was the Patsy and Hank and Patsy. We played with them some. We one time played with Lisa Loeb there. She played with us one time. It was just before her big song came, you know, made her a big star. But then when we moved over really to Naomi's, that's where we really felt the home for the band. And this was a little place on Canton Street that held about 60 people. If you ever went there, it was a true shithole, like a true old
yeah, but
school.
A lot of people talk about it with so much love. I never went there, but I mean, just the stories alone.
Yeah, and we I guess when I say we fit in there, it was us, a band called the Cartwrights, which was a mix of Barry Kuda and Donnie Ray Ford and Alan Woolley.
Was that the first time that you'd seen Barry? Had you seen any of his other bands?
I think I had seen I was at Clearview before. Before Old 97s. Just had seen him before, but I didn't. I might even not realize the same person. I knew about Nerve Breakers. I'd heard that before. Yeah. And so I kind of knew some things like that. So there was them, and Donnie had this band called Liberty Valance, a second band, the Sutcliffes. And we were also playing at Bar Soap. Those were the two big places there in that year window. It was before Barley House Days, which was kind of came like a year later. A girl named Mary Cutrafello, who's from Austin, was a shredder guitar player. And Mary came to one of our shows about 4 years ago in Minneapolis, out of blue. And was like, holy crap, Mary. I'd seen her in, you know, 25 years, 28 years. And so a little bit with Lone Star Trio was Matt Hillier's rockabilly band. So we would play with Lone Star Trio. Cowboys and Indians.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely terrific, right? Just horns and stuff. We got to be buddies with them. So these were the bands we would play with. The two big influences on the band that scene really laid down was the bluegrass thing, which was really a Killbilly thing. That's where Doreen comes from. I mean, Rhett went on tour with Killbilly, and like as a guitar player and singer, just like acoustic guitar player and singer, and he wrote Doreen on that tour. And the second thing being, swing was big, right?
Oh yeah,
swing was big. Cherry Pop and Daddies and all that stuff.
I mean, you can even hear that in Cowboys and Indians.
Well, that's what
that's
I was about
heavy,
to say.
Yeah.
We would play with Cowboy and Indians, and we would see. So in those days, everybody danced when they came to see the Old 97s. It was dancing, right? But part of that dancing would be more like swing dance instead of like country dance. And so we were like, yeah, we kind of could use a swing dance song. And so that's where Four Leaf Clover came from. So that was our, you know, boom, 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 boom. You know, dun, 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 all that swing, you know, it's a swing dance song, really, just with distorted guitars.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was 100%. From playing with those bands and being around those guys, that little scene is so, in my opinion, so underreported in DFW because partially I was part of it. So I saw them in full 3D, and a lot of times there are other bands from the 90s that some people talk up, and I'm like, really? Weren't they just the ones who opened for the band that played before Funland? You know? And I'm like, Cowboys and Indians is a real band.
Oh yeah. I never saw them live, I don't think, but I found out about them because the Observer used to put out those Seen Heard CDs, mm-hmm. and the song they had on there, I was like, oh, this is so great. And so I tracked down one of their albums, and I think you're right. There's so many bands like that. I mean, we should have heard more about.
Yeah, it was we were off Deep Ellum, like being off Broadway. We were playing at the Bar Soap, and you're playing at the Naomi's, and we didn't play Dada or anything like that. We one time opened for.
Did you ever play Adair's? I can't remember when it opened.
Did you know Adair's is open in the 60s?
Okay.
But Jack Ingram was always at Adair's.
Yeah,
we were always
I remember
at Naomi's
that.
And he didn't play Naomi's, and we didn't play Adair's. In the end, that's the line. That's the line. we're not a country band. Just never had been and never will be. We're just not those people. But we flirt with it enough that sometimes we get to go on tour with Willie Nelson and been on tour with Turnpike Troubadours. But
you did stuff with Merle, right?
No, not Merle.
Oh, what was that then?
Waylon Jennings.
Oh, Waylon, that's right. I knew it was one of those major names.
Yes, and we recorded a couple songs with Waylon Jennings his band and stuff like that. But, you know, these were legit, cool. I mean, look at the set list. They still have their band together. You know, these were real deal bands. And in a lot of ways, we were the fortunate one, I mean, that got to go do it for keeps, you know, out of that scene. But it was a legit scene. It was just different. The thing is, we all felt it was the weird deal where by 93, for me and for my friends, grunge seemed passe because we'd been hearing about this since about 88. And that felt like if you were starting a grunge band in 93 or 4, it's because you weren't behind the times is what you were. You know, you're starting the new wave band in 86. And so we in that weird way, we felt like we were the punk rockers still. Because we were doing the country music off, not on Elm Street, over there. And they were all sucking up to the man and trying to get their gig at Trees. This is the way we saw it.
Well, I'd say that's not necessarily incorrect. I think you've hit on something very accurate with that comment. Every time I went to Trees, as diverse as Trees was in the 90s, mm-hmm. I mean, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah. No, by the time we started... By the time we came into that world, which was around 96, 95, 96, you know, we were such a polished, so it probably felt like a new band of those people. But, you know, early days, we were playing three gigs a week all the time. Like the first year and a half we had the band, I bet we played certainly over 250 sets. Because we were always playing two sets, which you don't play two sets at Trees, you play one set. But we were playing at Bar Soap, we were playing two sets. Every time we played Naomi's two sets, every time we played Ginger Man three sets, on and on it would go, three sets at the Chumleys. So by the time that a lot of people that were looking for the next big thing in Dallas or whatever were coming to see us at Trees. So by the time we got to Trees, we were not a new band. We were doing well all over the United States. It was kind of a weird deal. It was a weird path because we weren't playing on the marquee, you know. Even though we had already, quote unquote, passed a lot of bands that probably people didn't realize it. Without calling any band names, I know for a fact that we had passed a lot of them because I was friends with them. And we had conversations. They're like, how are y'all doing this? I'm like, man, I don't really know, dude. Rhett Miller writes great songs. We play a lot of shows. We play a lot.
Well, and you guys had some good luck at South by Southwest. And it seems like some things just hit right.
But that was some, but like anything, it's... We already had things going on. See, that was 96.
Yeah.
So we were already, when the South by thing happened for us, we weren't sure we were already on Bloodshot. Anyway, we weren't sure what was going to happen at South by, and we certainly didn't expect what did happen, which was everybody trying to sign us. Even if nothing had happened there, we were already selling out all our shows in New York City, Washington, D.C., L.A., Seattle, Chicago. I mean, we were happening. Even if those things hadn't happened, we were, you know, doing well and having a good time and comfortable. I was even at that point comfortable, like, how long is this going to last and what is it going to mean? And if it had ended in 2 years, I would have said, man, I can't believe I got to do what I got to do, because I moved to Dallas just wanting to go see, you know, find Deep Ellum. I didn't know where Deep Ellum was, and I got to do all this stuff. So the reality was, it was killer.
And it did not end in 2 years. I mean, you guys have done well. And I mean, like getting to do the Marvel thing.
Yeah. It was crazy, right? Yeah, we've been in two movies. Like nobody, like I don't know anybody, you know, bands usually are not in movies. And we've been in that Vince Vaughn movie, Jennifer Aniston called The Breakup. And I thought, well, that's our movie, you know, and that was super fun too. And then it was completely upped on this Guardians thing. It was insane. It was so much fun. And we were dressed crazy. Everyone in there was crazy. It was super immersive just being on set. That's just a whole nother damn podcast.
I imagine so.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this. I know that we're getting about time to wrap up.
Right. I tell you what, there's a band I really like from those days that certainly didn't get enough cred. We never played a show with them. They're called Little Jack Melly and the Young Turks. And just an awesome band. Let's play one of their songs.
I think it's a good idea. Tell me this right before I hit play. Where do you remember seeing them?
Dada. They were a Dada band from my days of going down there watching the Cafe Noir band type. There's a band called White Man down there, which I believe was the guy that eventually was MC Nutter, but Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
But I know him as White Man. That was the name of that band, which he sort of rapped wearing a white suit, like, and he kind of looked like David Bowie. But I felt like the best one was this Dent band, Little Jack Melody, because there was real songwriting going on, real musicianship going on, and just as clever as hell, this clever band. And, you know,
and it's quirky too.
It's very quirky, and like most clever quirky bands, they go nowhere, right?
Yeah. I think I've got either two or three of their CDs.
Oh yeah.
And every time that I listen to it, I'm just like, this is probably the hardest band to say, oh, well, there was this other band in Texas that was doing this. It surprises me when somebody sticks out so uniquely.
The band they most, to me, overlapped with, and not a Texas band, was They Might Be Giants.
Oh, yeah. I could see
that's, yeah. And I was at that time really, that was one of the records, the first They Might Be Giants record that I had bought, and I was kind of into right when I first moved to Dallas. And they're not the same, but they're there, you know.
Sure.
It's just
they could share a bill, and you wouldn't feel awkward about it.
You wouldn't feel weird at all. And then later, when a band like Squirrel Nut Zippers comes, you're like, going, man, this could be a Little Jack Melody. It's
very, yeah,
it's
kind
of the same thing, you know, or cool thing like that.
There's a tiny bit of punk that ties them together.
Yeah.
There's definitely some danceability.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, yeah, let's go ahead and play them. I think we had a fun time. I really appreciate you being on.
Of course.
And I am sure we will be seeing you on stage here sometime again soon, because y'all always play Dallas.
Yeah, for sure.
Excellent.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully everyone else will tune in. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you very much, Jason. It was good. It's good to do your podcast. And I want one thing from you, something I've been wanting to ask you that you can give me. And it's very simple.
I'm ready.
You have an amazing photograph of the All-97s shot at one of our county fairs.
So what with all four of y'all?
And it's all four of us. And then the three people in the background that are looking across stage are my wife and my two kids.
Oh, I didn't even notice that. That's pretty crazy. Yeah, I've shot you guys so many times. And I shot you guys live at Trees. I've shot you guys live at Starplex. I've shot you guys live at your fair. I've done Gypsy. I mean, I can just sit here and count and count and count. But that one specific shot, when I hit that shot, I was like, oh my God, this is the shot.
Yes.
Yeah.
It ran in the morning news.
Yep,
didn't it?
That's correct.
And I'm sitting there looking at it and go, oh my God, that's y'all in the background. So I just would like a clear print of it.
Yeah, I can get you a copy of that for sure.
You know the photographer?
Yeah, there you go.
All right, cool, man.
Perfect. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Everyone, tune in next week. Thanks.
I'm so hungry, I can hardly think. I'm so hungry, never mind the drinks. I live upon the boulevard. I live a life that's very hard. Won't someone, some kind soul, help me out? J'ai faim toujours, toujours j'ai faim. I'm hungry always. J'ai faim toujours. I'm hungry always. Sometimes kind men frequent these cafes. Only blind men don't stop to appraise. I'd love to drink cold oligot. I'd love to sample cuisine's oat. Here I beg on the rue Pigalle. J'ai faim toujours, toujours j'ai faim. I'm hungry always. J'ai faim toujours, toujours j'ai faim. You for a while.
you hungry, je suis fini. A life of struggle I call mine, but we'll have fun, please pass the wine. Won't you please take a chance on me? J'ai faim toujours, toujours j'ai faim. J'ai faim.